actually see people.
Hi, everybody. My name is Adam Andrick. I'm a recovered alcoholic. All right. I got to kind of actually decompress a little bit. It's been a twitchy afternoon. I haven't been to a rehab in quite a while. How many people in here have been to the rooms before? That's it? Okay. Well, actually, it's most of you. There's only a couple who haven't. All right. First time I ever came to Alcoholics Anonymous, actually, it was NA that I first came to. I was probably 18 years old. And I went as support for my roommate. You know, we're living in this basement apartment. And it was about 14 of us in this one apartment. And one of the guys decided that he needed to go to meetings. And I went as, like I said, support. And I didn't think that I really had a problem at that point. But what I did find in the rooms there was I found a lot of people like me, you know. And I gravitated towards the people who weren't necessarily looking to do the right thing, you know. So my perception of 12-step fellowships was a place to go to get people off your back and to hook up with new connects. And that's how I viewed it until a few years later. Let me back up. I'll start from the beginning a little bit. I'm the oldest of three boys. I'm a byproduct of the 60s. My parents are only 17 and 20 years older than me, and I should have been born at Woodstock, but my mom backed out at the last minute. And growing up, I lived on a commune. I lived in a teepee. I lived in a school bus across the country 5 times before I was 5. And it was perfectly normal, perfectly acceptable to drink and get high. It was what I seen from everybody around me. It was a normal way of life. And you know, my first drink was probably at 2 years old. I remember hearing stories about my parents putting beer in my bottle and having me stumble around the parking lot and giggling at it and all that kind of stuff. But my first conscious drink was right around 12. I don't mean conscious drink. It was my first time intentionally going out with my friends to get loaded, you know, because I had drank a few times before that. And I went to a very small private school. I went to a Catholic school when I was a kid. And there was only 17 kids in my class, in my graduating junior high school class. And we all got loaded for the first time together, pretty much. There was a couple who didn't, but most of us did. And the first night I drank, I blacked out. We were down by the railroad tracks and sitting in this construction site, and we had 2 jugs of Gallo wine and a 6-pack of beer between like 5 of us. You know, we thought this might be enough, you know. And I drank to get loaded, and that was the only reason that I ever really drank. I never understood that social drinking thing. That was never part of my game plan ever. There was never an idea of I should control it. I should have a couple. That wasn't why I drank. I drank to get fucked up. And I also got high to get fucked up. I don't know why anybody else would. Any other reason for it. And by 16 years old, I had been drinking regularly. I had been smoking weed. I think I did some coke around then too. I know by 18, I was a full-blown acid head and a daily drunk. I do talk about the drugs a bit, but it's, you know, drugs came and went. You know, the booze was always on the table for me. It was the first thing that I started with, and it was the last, well, it wasn't the last thing I gave up. The last thing I gave up was a weed, but it was still, the booze was still there. The booze was still an issue. Part of the reason I gave up the weed was I realized I couldn't smoke pot and stay sober. You know, and I had to give up the weed in order to give up the booze. You know, the booze was a steady, it was a constant, it was always there. I knew what I was getting with it, you know. I knew which type of alcohol I had to drink to get to a certain place. With all the drugs that I did over the years, you never knew what you got, you know. You got high, you know, but you never knew what you got, you know. And I was all in for that, but, you know, like I said, the constant was the booze. I moved onto the streets for the first time when I was 16 years old. I figured it was an easier way to live than to actually get a job and, you know, be a productive member of society and go to school regularly and all that stuff. By the time I was 18, I was out there full time, you know, and my theory about it was, why live in a $50,000 house when you can live under a $50 million bridge? I was camping out under the stars. That was the way I looked at it. You know, I had this great little cave that I made. I didn't make the cave. It was made out of vines, but we kind of cleared it all out. I had a little clothesline in there, a bedroll, my radio, you know, and I had the creek right there that I could swim in and take my baths. Yeah. And I was a clean homeless person. Yeah. I was out there in a bar of soap in the creek. But I, you know what? That was part of my deal too, though, because I was a drug dealer. And I didn't want to look like a degenerate. I wanted to blend in as a college student. I lived in a college town. And I needed to blend in. I was on a mountain bike. I had a backpack and a pocket full of whatever. And that's how I got through my day. And that's how I maintained my my addiction. What's the word I'm looking for? I don't know. I lost my thought there for a second. It's all right. I was living in San Francisco, and San Francisco's got a very laid back atmosphere about drugs. It's all wide open out in the street. If any of you guys know the city here, it's like Harlem, you know, or whatever. You know, it's all out in the open, but it's in large quantities. And I came back to my hometown, which is a town called Chico in Northern California, and I had a 79 hits of acid on me, and it was just weekend party material, but a cop got me, and I ended up doing 2 years for possession, and they tried to get me possession with intent to sell, but as part of the plea bargain, as long as I didn't go to rehab, I could get 2 years. That's what they told me, and California was pretty messed up in that way. But while I was locked up, I kind of came to the realization that every time I got in trouble, it was in or around getting high. You know, I didn't always get in trouble when I was drunk and loaded, but every time I got in trouble, it was around that. And so I started to see a pattern, and I started to think maybe there's a problem. I started writing letters. I started talking to people. I started trying to figure out a way to get out of this cycle. You know, I wanted to go into a rehab. I needed to do something. But back then, it wasn't, I don't know, I didn't know where to go or how to do it, but it wasn't nearly as accessible as it is today. And but I did my 2 years, or it was actually about a year and a half I got out. And they gave me $200 gate money. And within 20 minutes, I had a six-pack of beer. Within 2 hours, I had a pint of schnapps in my back pocket, 2 hits of acid in my system, and a half ounce of weed down my pants. And I was living outside again. Within 2 hours of being locked up. I woke up the next morning, and I realized that, you know, I'm going to be like all these other guys that I know. You know, everybody I knew at that point was either dead or doing life on the installment plan. You know, they'd be doing 6 months. They do a year. They get out for 3 months. They go back, do another year and a half. They get out for 6 months. Go, you know, in and out their whole lives. And that was everybody that I knew. And I knew for myself, being locked up wasn't hard. It was actually quite easy. I was told when to eat, when to sleep, when to shit, when to work out, when to watch TV, when to do whatever it is I had to do. And I didn't have a problem with that. You know, I wasn't looking to be responsible and productive, and you know, I was fine playing cards and watching TV and doing my thing. Plenty of stuff inside. It wasn't an issue. But I also didn't want to, you know. And so I called my parole officer. I hadn't even seen her yet. And I said, I need to go to New Jersey. I got family in Jersey. If I don't go, there's no way I'm going to be able to stay out, you know. So I moved back east. And I tried to be productive. I moved in with my mother, who was in AA, and her one contingency was that I don't get loaded. And that lasted like 2 days, maybe, you know. I was pretty good for a few months in the sense of not doing it at home or being wasted when I came home. But I lasted 2 days before I got high. I was probably about 22 years old, I guess it was at this time. I had gotten 2 dirty tests, a petty theft and a DUI. And I was on parole. And I knew I was going back to jail, so I called my PO and I asked her if she could let me, you know, give me a chance to go to rehab. So I went into detox down in Secaucus, and I... first place they sent me to was this place down in New Brunswick called Damon House. And I walked in there, I was there an hour, you know, talking to the people. And they make you wear dunce caps and diapers and, you know, all this, you know, I don't know, screwed up TC stuff. And I called my PO and I said, I won't stay there. You know, there's no locks on the doors. There's nothing keeping me in. I'm not going to stay in a place like that. If you give me another 24 hours, I'll find a place. And I got into the Salvation Army down in Newark. And not a good rehab, but it did save my life. Because the one thing that I got from that place was... they told me when I walked in there, they said that I had to get a relationship with God in order to get sober. And that's the only thing that I learned from that place. It's the only thing I got. And I started going to meetings. And I started getting the buzz, I guess you would call it. That newly sober, they call it a pink cloud thing. You know, I started to feel good about being sober. And... and I'd go to meetings, and I'd go to meetings, and I'd share about my stuff and, you know, do all the stuff the fellowship is telling you to do, and, you know, 90 and 90 and all that. And the one thing they told me, though, is they said, if you got a reservation, you got to talk about it. And so I started talking about wanting to smoke pot. And I started talking about it and talking about it and talking about it and talking about it. And I drove myself insane, and I went and smoked pot. But in my deluded mind at the time, I really didn't believe that I had relapsed. Because my problem's not weed, it's booze, you know. So I kept going to meetings. And I kept sharing in meetings. And I kept talking. And, I know all the good shit to say now, you know. But I'm smoking a joint afterwards. And eventually, my head got so screwed up from doing that that I knew I needed to stop. But... like I said, my mind was so screwed up that I didn't think that I relapsed. So I had to go out and drink. so I could come back to AA for real. And I picked up a drink and I couldn't stop for 2 years. I went to meetings every single day. Sometimes 4 times a day. And I couldn't stop. I went to detoxes. I went into, you know, inpatient things. I could not stay stopped. I did everything that the fellowship asked me to do. You know, like I said, I went to meetings every day. I had a sponsor. I talked to people. I shared about my problems. I had a coffee commitment. I went bowling after the meeting. I went to the diner. I did all the barbecue bullshit. You know, the one thing I didn't do was the steps. But at the time, they told me, you don't need to worry about that yet. You know, you're not sober enough yet to do that stuff. And I drank for close to 3 years inside Alcoholics Anonymous and couldn't put together more than a week. There was this old guy. His name was Bill Adams. He's from Bayonne, New Jersey. And he used to go to this candlelight meeting. And he used to talk about, he said something and it stuck with me. He said, sobriety is a gift from God, and what you do with it is your gift back. And it got filed in the back of my head. And the last time I went out, all I could do was hear his voice. It drove me insane. You know, I drank for 2.5 months, and every day I heard his voice. You know? And it killed me. You know, and he used to talk about grabbing drunks and bringing them back to his house and reading the big book to them. And I didn't know what he meant, because at the time I'd only been reading the stories and, you know, and identifying and this and that and the other thing. But the last time I came in, I picked up that book and I started to read. And right in the front of the book, it's in the preface, I believe, it says that this is the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew what that meant. It clicked. It was kind of like this moment of clarity. You know, a textbook is something that's going to give me instructions. It's going to tell me how to do something. And I started to read that book, and it started to make sense. And I started to take the action that it was telling me to take. You know, and it described alcoholism, and I had never understood what it meant to be an alcoholic. You know, I thought being an alcoholic was that, you know, I drank a case of beer before I went to a keg party. You know, that's what makes me an alcoholic. I thought, I get locked up when I drink, that makes me an alcoholic. Or I was homeless, that makes me an alcoholic. No. What makes me an alcoholic is that when I pick up a drink, I can't guarantee what's going to happen. You know, I may be able to drink 2 beers and put it down, or I may drink 30 and pass out. You know, and then there's this other aspect that I have this thing they call a mental obsession. You know, that somehow, someday, I'm going to control and enjoy my drinking. And I may not even think of it like that. I just won't remember how fucked up it was last week. And I'll say it'll be different this time. And I'll be able to handle it this time. Or, fuck it. I don't care. You know, the consequences, the potential consequences of picking up a drink don't outweigh the uncomfortability that I'm in right now. You know. But the problem is those potential consequences for me for being an alcoholic is death. I just don't see it that way. You know, I don't see, you know, I'm 24 years old, 25 years old. I ain't going to die from this. You know, I'm still invincible, you know, and, but that's what it means to be an alcoholic. And then there's that underlying thing that drives the whole issue, and that's my spiritual malady. That's that restless, irritable, discontented feeling that I have when I'm sober. When I don't have a solution in my life and I'm without a drink or a drug, I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. My life is just kind of sucks. It may not be horrible, but it just ain't right. You know. And that's that. When I live in that state for long enough, what ends up happening is the idea of a drink starts looking good. And once the idea of a drink starts looking good, I start telling myself, well, it wasn't that bad. Once I start telling myself it wasn't that bad, I start thinking about how I'm going to do it. Once I start to do it, I can't stop. You know, so it's not putting the plug in the jug that solves my problem. What solves my problem is addressing that restless, irritable, discontented feeling, that uncomfortability that I have. So it took me 3.5 years, give or take, of coming to AA before I actually even knew what being an alcoholic was. You know, but once I started to read that book and I found out what being an alcoholic was, I had this motivation, for lack of a better word, you know, this driving force. They use the phrase, the desperation of a drowning man, you know, and I had that. And you know, when I can accept that first step, you know, and the first step is not that I'm gonna, that I can't drink. The first step is I will drink, you know. Basically, the first step tells me I'm fucked. Plain and simple, you know, without a power greater than myself, without something to intervene, I'm screwed, you know. And the second step is real easy, you know. Can I believe that I'm not God? Yeah, it tells us. It says it in the book. It asks the question, you know, do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe that there's a power greater than myself? The only loophole to that statement is that I believe that I'm God. So if I can believe that I'm not God, I can take my second step and I can move on. You know, I don't need to understand what God is. I didn't understand God. I still don't understand God. But in my first year, I had no clue what God was. You know, I didn't even know if I believed in God. I just knew that I wasn't it. You know, and that's all I needed. And the third step says basically made a decision to turn our will in our lives. What is my will? My will is my thoughts. So I'm going to turn my thoughts and my life, which is my actions, over to the care and direction of this something that's going to fix me. I don't know what it is yet, you know. Because at the time, like I said, I was raised Catholic, but I had no desire whatsoever to seek out that Catholic God that I was raised with. I figured I was going to hell from the time I was in the third grade, you know. I needed to find something new. And what I ended up using for my higher power in that beginning was a set of principles. I used the principles that were common to all the religions of the world, whatever they were, the ones that were the same for everything. You know, because 8 billion people, 7 billion people, if you line up with certain things, can't be wrong. You know what I mean? You know, they all believe in these one, two, three, four different things. Can't be wrong. Compassion, love, honesty, you know, unselfishness. That's my higher power. These are a set of principles that I'm incapable of living up to perfectly. That's greater than me. I can use that. So I turn my thoughts and my actions over to the care and direction of these set of principles. Problem is at that point, I don't know what my thoughts and my actions are yet. I just know that I got this big pile of shit, you know, which is my life. You know, so it's like a blind surrender. It's just giving up. I can't do this. I got to move towards this other thing. You know, but how do I find out what my thoughts and my actions are? I did inventory. You know, I worked through my fourth step, and you know what? My first fourth step was a pile of garbage. It was 90% lies, and it was a mess. But it was as honest as I possibly could have been at that time. And it wasn't my last, you know. It gave me enough to move on, you know. Up until that point, I believed I was the biggest piece of shit on the planet, or on a better day, I'm just a nice guy who drank too much. You know, I had this kind of opposite views, you know, polar opposites. There was no balance, there was no humility. And I brought this garbage inventory to my first sponsor, and I started sharing it with him. And I came out the other side of this inventory after sharing it with him, realizing some truth about me, that I wasn't just a nice guy who drank too much, and I wasn't a big giant piece of crap. I was somewhere in the middle, you know. I was screwed up. I did a lot of screwed up stuff, but you know what? I'm still human, you know, and I'm not Satan incarnate, you know. 6 and 7 was easy. 6 and 7 was a piece of cake. You know, because I look at my life, and this is what I've done. These are my defects of character that I lived with for the past 25 years. This is what I've done. Do I want this gone? Yeah. You know, I want a better way. It was easy. That was it. Say the prayer. I move on. So between 5 and 9, I was looking at like 2 hours. Because at the end of the fifth step, it tells me that I'm supposed to take a quiet hour and make sure I meditate on whether I missed anything. You know, whether I left anything out. Yeah. Say the prayer. And then take my fourth step and transfer it over to an 8-step list. That's all it takes. You know, it takes 2 hours, max. And that's if you got 100-something names like I did the first time around. You know, a lot of the people that I sponsor, I get a lot of chronic relapsers, a lot of people who can't stay clean, and I don't make them write hundreds of names. You know, I tell them start writing who you're pissed off at. You know, and 2 days later, how you doing with that? I can't seem to get any more. Okay, start writing why, and now show up at my house tomorrow. You know, and then we talk the rest out. You know, and I help them do the rest of their 4-step as they're doing their 5th step. You know, and we got 20 names, 25 names. It's enough to get started. And what I tell them, the only thing that I tell them not to do is do not edit on purpose. Don't think a name and leave it off intentionally. Because if it comes to mind, it belongs there. You know, because you're not going to, the first time ain't the end. I find that I keep doing this stuff over and over again. I just did a round of inventory this last year. You know, I finished it up in August. You know. So, you know, and I'm coming up on 19 years. You know, this doesn't end. You know, it's something that I got to continue to do. That first round of amends, I took all the names off of my 4-step, and I went out to apologize and set right the harms that I made. You know, I paid back what money I could. I made payment plans to those that I couldn't make it, but I always brought money. That's what I was taught. I was taught, don't show up and say, can I pay you next Tuesday? You know, no, I come up with $20 and say, can I make a payment plan and I'll show up every month with this amount? You know, but always bring something. I tried to set right the harms that I had done up until that point. And then I did this little cheesy-ass 10-11 because I really didn't know what I was doing at the time. You know, and I was trying to help others. I went back into Alcoholics Anonymous and I had this fire, I guess you would call it. This excitement about recovery. And like I said, I was in these meetings that weren't necessarily promoting the idea of the steps. You know, they were talking about share about your feelings and share about your issues and your inner child. And, you know, that stuff's all well and good. You know, I don't know an alcoholic who doesn't need therapy, but Alcoholics Anonymous is not therapy. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship with a program to solve my alcohol problem. Okay? Therapy is therapy. 2 separate issues. You know, and I started sharing this solution out of the big book, and I started sharing the message, and I came across as a very judgmental douchebag, you know, for quite a while, because I was coming back and I was swinging is what it was. As I'd walk into 12 and 12 meetings with my big book and share about how they're doing it wrong and, you know, and all this kind of shit. And I did that for 4 years, 4.5 years. And I helped create this antagonism towards big book thumpers in my old home group area, you know. And I found the error. I see the error of my ways now, you know, after dealing with this, because I had to go back and make amends in recovery for being, you know, judgmental, for being self-righteous, you know. And I missed a really key line. There's a line in the, I believe it's in the 9th step. It says that we fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. You know. Now, if I'm walking into a meeting and I'm beating the book and I'm yelling and I'm foaming at the mouth and I'm talking all this trash, am I really fitting myself to be of maximum service? You know, all I'm doing is alienating myself. You know, I'm scaring away the people who don't need that kind of method. You know, I'm pissing off the ones who are already sober, and I might be grabbing one or two if I'm lucky. You know, and I found that this wasn't effective. It took me quite a while to really realize this, but at a certain point, I started to change my method. I started to change my approach. I don't change what I do, but I change the way I present it. You know, and the simplest way I had to do this was I went back into these meetings. I was in a meeting. My home group at the time was this very fundamentalist big book meeting, and we were very, very much into the book, very much into doing the deal. But we all had this kind of arrogance, you know, and we kind of fed off each other. And I found that I needed to leave that, and I walked away, and I went back into the mainstream fellowship. And I started to share this message in a different way. You know, I stopped talking about the big book and stopped being a step Nazi, you know. But I didn't stop sharing about the process, and I didn't stop sharing about the literature. And I stopped sharing about God a little bit, but I started sharing a little more about higher power. And you know, and then when I hooked them, I'd bring them back to the house and beat them over the head with the book, you know. Because, you know, the bottom line is that's where the answer is. It's in there. The fundamentals are necessary, but the approach can be done in such a way, you know, I'm a dope fiend. I can utilize this skill that I have, you know. You know, and I have a friend of mine who used to always talk about setting the hook. And I didn't get that until later on, you know, and that's what that is. You know, come in and talk about the solution. Talk about God. Talk about the freedom that I got. Set the hook. Then when you bring them back, now you got to do this. You know, but the founders, that's what they did. You know, they talked about the hopeless nature. They talked about the plus. You know, all the good shit, the God in their life, and how this all worked, and then brought them through the steps. You know, and it's not a long, arduous process. It doesn't have to be. You know, it can be. You can make it as long and arduous as you want it to be, but it doesn't have to be. I've taken people through the steps in a weekend, and then I've also done it where it's taken a year to bring some guy through the steps. But he wasn't, the guy who took a year wasn't goofing off. He was doing his writing every day. He was doing his meetings. He was doing his outpatient. He was, you know, doing his family obligations. But he was doing his writing. He brought me this War and Peace 4-step, which I looked at and I was like, we're not reading this. You know, start telling me about your wife. You know, she wrote it. You needed to write this. That's fine. But we're not gonna sit here for 3 weeks and read over your inventory because it's just keeping you stuck. Let's look at the issues. Let's look at what the real deal is, you know, because the purpose in my experience of what 4 and 5 are all about is two things. One is showing me a pattern of behavior. I can figure out a pattern of behavior after 20 friggin' names, okay? Sometimes it takes more, but I can figure out a pattern of behavior after 20. And the other is to remove the big crap in the way of my connection to God. You know, it's like I got all this shit down here, and God's deep down inside every man, woman, and child, okay? I got all this crap in here. I need to get in there, and I need to shovel it out and open up a channel. That's what it's all about. You know, it's the stuff that blocks me. You know? I have a prayer today that I use whenever I go to write inventory, and it's a very simple prayer. God, please show me what blocks me from you and my fellows. And then I start to write. You know, I don't think about it anymore. I don't analyze it anymore. The 12 steps are a spiritual process. They're not an analytical process. You do that analyzing stuff with a therapist. You do somebody that's qualified to look at your inner child shit. Okay? You're doing inventory. Inventory is a spiritual process. It's something that removes the blockages between you and your higher power. And it allows that channel to flow through. Because without that higher power, I'm screwed. Remember step one? You know, I'm restless, irritable, discontent. I think I can do it again. And once I do it, I can't stop. And the only thing that stands between me and that drink is my relationship with my higher power. That new way of life. And it's not belief. It's a relationship. It's something that I have to work on a daily basis. Because my default setting is fuck you, God. That's my default setting. You know, I still do it to this day. You know, I know with every fiber of my being that if I wake up in the morning and I say, God, what do you got for me today? And I go about and I do that, my life's going to be wonderful. And I also know at the same time that if I wake up in the morning and I say, screw you, God, I got this, my life is going to suck. But on any given day, I will say, screw you, God, I got this. That's my default setting. You know, I open my mind, I open my eyes in the morning and my first thought is, screw you, God, I got this. You know, that's why I have the tools that I have. You know, part of the 11th step tells me that there's a prayer. God, please direct my thinking. Help it be divorced of selfish, self-pitying, self-seeking, whatever. I forget the exact words. I have it written down. I'm bad with remembering. And what I did is when I first was given this prayer, I taped it to my ceiling above my bed. So that when I opened my eyes in the morning, it was the first thing that I seen. Because it's that time. It's that wake up in the morning, and I open my eyes, and screw you. Oh, yeah, God, direct my thinking. You know, it's that quick for me. You know, and if I forget to pray in the morning, now, again, if I miss that, I walk into my bathroom to, you know, do my morning stuff, and I've got a prayer hanging on my mirror. I got a prayer hanging behind my toilet, you know, because again, these are the things that are going to keep me sober. It's not about how many meetings I make. I'm lucky if I make 3 meetings in a week. I typically make 1 or 2. You know, I've got 4 kids. You know, I've got a job, a side business, and what do I got? About 7 sponsees right now. You know, I'm lucky if I make 3. I usually make 1 or 2. You know, if I needed to make meetings every day in order to stay sober, I'd be dead. You know, but I was taught that meetings are not what keep me sober. Meetings are where I go to look for you guys, to look for the newcomer, to carry the message. Okay? I get my recovery on the phone, at my kitchen table, at my sponsor's kitchen table, you know, worst case scenario on Skype, you know, I've done that, you know, and in my prayer life, you know. Because the bottom line is it's between me and God. The people in my life are just, they're the go-between, you know. When I'm off, you know, which happens regularly, you know, I've got people in my life to say, Adam, you're full of shit, you know, look at that, you know, wake up. Did you go to God? You know, I'm teaching. I got these two sponsees right now that they're very caught up in the human power thing, and I got to go to meetings. I got to talk to my sponsor. I got to talk to my network and do all this stuff. And what I'm teaching them right now is you got to go to God first, and then you go to them. You know, it takes time to get that right, so you better go to them also. You know, to get that God consciousness right. But the 10th step tells me that I watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. I ask God to remove this. Then I discuss it with another person, making amends if I need to, and then turn my thoughts to somebody I can help. You know, so I go to God first, and then I discuss it with somebody. You know, basically I go to God, I ask God for guidance, I bring that guidance to another person to make sure that I'm not deluding myself and full of shit and telling myself what I want to hear, you know. And then I go about turning my thoughts to somebody else, you know. So the people in my life are backup. My source is supposed to be my higher power, you know. Granted, in the beginning, I absolutely needed people. I needed people for years, you know. But I'm a slow learner, you know. I've watched people grow really quickly in the fellowship, you know. I got a sponsee right now. Kid blows me away. He's really amazing. Within a year, he was on point with his guidance. He was on point with his connection with God. You know, it took me damn near 7 years to start getting accurate guidance. You know, I'm thick. You know, this kid blew me away. And I don't know if he's the norm and I'm the weirdo, or if I'm the norm and he's the weirdo. But, you know, the idea is you got to have the backup. You got to have the people. 11-step is ever-changing in my life. You know, I've got my basics. My basics is, I think it's page 86 to 88 in the big book. It starts with the nightly review, which everyone thinks is part of the 10th step, but in the big book, it's part of the 11th step. Nightly review, was I resentful today? Was I selfish? Was I thinking of other people or thinking mostly of myself? Was I packing into the stream of life? Do I owe an apology? There's 12 questions in there. I ask myself on a nightly basis. It tells me when I retire at night. You know what? When I retire at night, doesn't have to be when I put my head on my pillow. Sometimes when I retire at night is when I'm on the way home from work. You know, sometimes when I retire at night is, you know, 8 o'clock. Sometimes it's 5 o'clock. It just depends. For me, that's what I needed. Some people need the structure. Okay. What I do with the structure is the good Catholic boy in me. I sit, kneel, stand, say the response. There's nothing going from the head to the heart. It becomes ritual. It becomes habit. It doesn't mean anything. And I did that for a period of time. You know, I dotted the I's and crossed the T's and did it perfectly the way I was supposed to, and there was nothing going into my heart. I needed to break it up. And I found that God doesn't give a shit when I talk to him as long as I do. You know, that was really important to me. Because, you know, I used to think that if I missed my nightly review, I was screwed, you know, and then I'd blow it off for a month, you know, and wreck my life to the ground. So I find if I miss my nightly review, I wake up in the morning and I do it. I can still do yesterday's nightly review tomorrow morning, you know, it still works, you know. Take my nightly review into the morning, and the morning meditation asked us, you know, to review yesterday's day and see what we have to do today. So whatever I screwed up in yesterday, I get to fix it today. I get to make the amends if I didn't. You know, I get to change behaviors if I, you know, acted out badly. You know, I get to go about the normal stuff that I got to do, and that's part of my morning meditation. You know, I like it. I love my winters. My winters, because then I get up early in the morning in the winter, and I sit in front of the fire. I start the fire for the house, and I do my prayer meditation in front of the fire. Weather's changing now. I need to find a new spot, but that's probably going to be the swing on the porch. I like that too. But that's always been a useful, you know, again, the flexibility is important to me. It really is. Because I get caught in ritual. I get caught in the regiment. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, okay, spiritual awakening is what this is all about. The spiritual awakening is what relieves me. I identified myself when I sat up here as a recovered alcoholic. Okay. This doesn't mean that I can drink. It means that I don't actively drink, and I don't have the obsession to drink. I haven't thought about picking up a drink in over 14 years. It hasn't crossed my mind. At 10 years, I wanted to eat a bullet. But I didn't think about drinking. I had a really rough patch between 7 and 10 years. It was almost got a divorce, went insane, moved in with my mom, who's an active psychopath. She's an alcoholic and a drug addict, but thinks she's sober because she doesn't drink and she takes prescription medicine. It doesn't have to be prescribed to her, and it doesn't have to be as prescribed, but it's prescription, so it's okay. Yeah. She's a piece of work, you know, and robo tripping's okay. I moved into her house, and she asked us to move in with my family. Asked us to move in and help her. You know, she was having trouble with the bills, and so we moved in to try and help her. It's out of her mind, and you know, there's that cliche you hear in the rooms about people, places, and things. You know, there's a reason behind that. Okay, you may not get drunk over people, places, and things, but your attitudes and your behaviors, you're like a sponge, or I'm like a sponge. You know, I take on the flavor of whatever's around me. And if I'm around somebody really sick and I have history with them, I start to kind of shift back into that a little bit. And I did. I lasted a whole 6 months there before we fled. You know, and we literally did. We found an apartment, got the truck, and we moved out within 3 days. It was bad. You know, so yeah, I have thought about giving up. I have thought about other things. But you know what? The thoughts that did occur were immediately followed by, what are you, insane? You know, there's a paragraph in the 10-step called the 10-step promises, and it says, we ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. We'll seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil as if from a hot flame. Okay? I've never been interested in liquor. I've seldom been interested in other things, running, whatever. But I recoiled as if from a hot flame. You know? I jumped back and said, what? I can't believe I just thought that. And it happened that quickly. You know? It was not sitting with it. It wasn't pondering it, you know, mulling it over or any of that stuff. Hence the recovered alcoholic. And the reason that that this has happened to me is a direct result of the 12 steps. That's what they're designed to do. They're designed to produce that psychic change that they talk about in the doctor's opinion. That change in perception, that change in reality. You know, if I stayed anything close to being the same person that I was when I walked in here, there's no way I could have stayed sober. You know, that person drank and drugged as a matter of course. You know, any situation in my life, I drank and drugged over. You know, whether it be a good day or a bad day, whether it be sunny or rainy, whether I had a good job or a bad job, whether I had a good girlfriend or, you know, a friend of mine uses the term married to Satan's sister. You know, no matter what, I always did that. You know. So I needed to change at a core level. And it wasn't a matter of cutting my hair or changing my t-shirt or any, it wasn't that stuff. You know, they told me when I first came in, I needed to stop listening to the Grateful Dead in order to get sober. And I was like, what are you, high? You know, that's not what it's about. I know it's not what it's about. You know, cause I still listen to the Dead. You know, I also listen to a lot of new stuff, you know, which I'm really cool. I'm excited about. Being sober opened me up to new stuff. It allowed me to get out of the old mindset. You know. So having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we carry this message to others, especially alcoholics, and practice these principles in all our affairs. I know that's not the way it's written on the wall, but that's the way the original manuscript writes it. Actually, they say having had a spiritual experience as the result of this course of action, we carry this message to others, especially alcoholics. And the idea is how do we carry this message to others, not just alcoholics? What's the message? The message isn't about not drinking. The message is about a relationship of reliance and dependence upon a higher power. You know, living my life. You know, AA doesn't, for me, doesn't happen in a church basement or in a rehab or wherever, you know, we meet. AA happens down in Mr. Z's, you know, it happens in Walmart, it happens on Route 80, you know, it happens wherever I go. I've got to bring this way of life with me. You know, there's a line in the literature that says the spiritual life is not a theory, we have to live it. You know, this isn't something that I ponder or I consider or, you know, We used to have this 12 and 12 meeting that I used to go to when I was first brand new. And everybody always liked to think about the steps. You know? And we'd read the step and everybody would share this normal share. Well, I haven't done this step yet, but when I do, I think I'll do it this way. You know? That's not what the spiritual life is about. You know? The spiritual life is about action. It's about taking these principles and applying them into my life. You know, doing the right thing when the right thing sucks. You know, and I, very, very simple example, these sunglasses. About a month ago, I'm on my way home from work and I pull into the truck stop there in Columbia, right off of 80. and I get a Red Bull and a pair of sunglasses, a couple Red Bulls and a pair of sunglasses, and I hand the guy his money and I walk out the door, not even paying attention, I'm just doing it. I get on 80 and I realize he gave me too much money back. He never charged me for the shades. Yeah, no big deal. They're $8 sunglasses or $9 sunglasses. But I know that if I don't go back and give the guy his money, you know, it's going to fuck with me. Because I don't live like that anymore. I ain't trying to get over. I got the $8 or $9. I was willing to give it up when I walked up to the counter. You know, it may not seem like a big deal, but it back in the, I would have never considered it. Ooh, ground score, freebie. You know, but I don't live like that anymore. I don't do that stuff anymore. And it actually took me a couple days to get back, and the lady looked at me like I had three heads. You know, what do you mean? You left your sunglasses? No, I didn't pay for them. She's like, oh, okay. You know, and just little stuff like that. You know, because the little stuff, if I don't do the little stuff, then it's okay to do the bigger stuff. Then it's okay to do the bigger stuff. And the bigger and the bigger and the bigger. And next thing you know, I'm living under a fucking bridge, drinking Thunderbird and dealing drugs again. You know, I don't want that. You know, I love my life today. You know, I really do. You know, I get this amazing opportunity to be of service and to help people. You know, and to watch people lighten up. You know, it's so cool when you see somebody when they get it. You know, and the light goes on inside their eye, and ooh yeah, that's it. It's an amazing thing. You know, I didn't get that spiritual experience that the 12 steps talking about until that actually happened. I had been through the steps a couple times and was doing it more analytical and working it for me. And then I seen it happen to somebody else and all of a sudden it clicked and it made sense. You know, so, you know, the bottom line is the steps are the answer. You know, actually the steps aren't the answer. The steps are the vehicle. The answer is God, you know, however you want to call it, you know what I mean? I'm not a religious person by any means, you know. My God's name is Sam. It's an acronym. It stands for Sure Ain't Me. And it's been that way for 19 years now, and it still works, you know. My conception has evolved, you know, it's changed, and it's become a little more uniform, and you know, I have to do what I did in my first year. I'd never stay sober doing today, you know, because my conscious and you know and all that stuff has gotten a little more defined. But my understanding of God is still, I don't know what it is, and I don't have to, you know. I think God is too big for me to understand, you know. It really is. There's a line in the book that said, either God is everything or God is nothing. God either is or he isn't. What is my choice to be? Well, God's everything to me. That means I invite God into every area of my life. Even when it's inconvenient. You know, because I've seen what happens when I don't invite him when into the areas. You know, I've made damn near every mistake you can think about in recovery. You know, because I didn't invite God into those areas. You know, and I paid the price. But today, God willing, he's in every area. You know, and I got a wonderful life. I've got kids at home that want me to come home. I've got a wife at home that wants me to come home. You know, I didn't have that. You know, I had people looking out there going, oh no, not him. You know, it's an amazing thing. And like I said, it was just about giving up and following some simple instructions. You know, the book says further on are clear-cut instructions on how we recover. Follow the directions, get the result. That's all I got. Thanks.